Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. This week, Municipal Clerk Barbara Grunstein resigns. Resource Development Council luncheon turns into a rally here in Anchorage. We learn more about the supporters of Ron Paul taking over the Republican Party, and we learn more about the fate of several prosecutors in the Ted Stevens misconduct trial. Let's first turn to Paul Jenkins. We'll be joined by Steve McDonald and Tim Bradner, but Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Ted Stevens latest misconduct revelations.
Well, this is the second of two lengthy investigations into the conduct of the prosecution team during the Ted Stevens trial. The first one was done by Prosecutor Schulke. He was hired by the judge to conduct the investigation. This one was done by the Office of Professional Responsibility in the Justice Department. They issued a 600-page report this week. They named two lawyers, Joe Bettini and James Gecki, and as being irresponsible, unprofessional, withholding information from the Stevens defense team, and they suggested a 15-day suspension for Gecki, 40 days for Bettini. What it goes from here, I don't think anybody really knows. They've got an appeals process that they're going to pursue, at least Bettini is, I guess, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Steve, you want to add anything here?
No, just the reaction of this has been pretty interesting, or the reaction to this,
right.
I should say, that Senator Lisa Murkowski, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas, both came out and said this is laughable. This is just an insignificant punishment for something that these two attorneys, these two prosecutors did during the trial. Also, there was the same feelings from Brendan Sullivan, who headed up Senator Stevens' defense team. They just feel that this isn't any kind of punishment at all for these two gentlemen for what they did. They feel that they violated the Constitution. The Department of Justice comes out and says, yes, they did make mistakes. They did withhold evidence that could have been beneficial to the defense team, but they did it. They didn't do it on purpose. They did it. It was a mistake.
It wasn't a flagrant foul.
It wasn't a flagrant foul, so you're only suspended for one game.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Not like the guy from the Miami Heat. But yeah, so a very loud outcry from the folks, from supporters of Senator Stevens.
Okay. Municipal Clerk Barbara Grunstein resigns and becomes the second city official to depart in the wake of the botched April municipal election. Paul, maybe this thing, her departure could have been predicted, not predicted, but it wasn't surprising.
Why do you call it botched? It was certainly not surprising. The deputy clerk was fired by Ernie Hall, Assembly chairman, a week or so ago.
That was Ms. Duke.
Ms. Duke. And she was kind of responsible for running the election. She was a hands-on person. Her boss, the deputy or city clerk, Barbara Grunstein, I think everyone was wondering when the other shoe was going to drop. And she may have beat being fired by resigning. But the election itself, we still don't know everything that happened. It'll be a while before we do. And botched is a very nice term for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe even some would say an understatement.
Understatement.
We're not taking positions here. Steve, and what do we hear about the continuing examination, investigation with the retired judge who's supposed to, at Mr. Hall's behest, get to the bottom of this?
Yeah, right. Assembly Chairman Ernie Hall is the one who hired the former attorney to conduct this investigation. And we really don't know anything. He's in the midst of doing this right now. I think a little later on this summer, probably another month or so, 6 weeks perhaps, we'll learn what he finds out, what happened. He'll do, I'm sure, a lot of interviews with poll workers, probably talk to people there in the clerk's office as well, and talk to some people who feel maybe they were disenfranchised on April 3rd when some were turned away at the polls. They had to wait long periods of time. Some were told to go to other polls to cast ballots, and they were out of it, and they just gave up and went home. So it's a very serious thing. I figure if government should do one thing well, it should be run an election. And that didn't happen here.
But in any case, if I might,
yes.
the election has been certified.
Election has been certified
a couple times.
That's right. We had people who were elected and waiting to take their positions on the Anchorage Assembly. No, there was no assembly members up, but school board. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there was a mayor. I got that. But we had some people on the school board who were newly elected. They weren't incumbents being reelected, so they had to take their positions. And so they had to get on with the business of the election. And this, I don't think anything's going to change. I mean, obviously, we're not going to have any. They've recounted some of the precincts. All of these things passed or were defeated, or these candidates won or lost by wide margins. And I don't think they're going to find any discrepancies that's going to change the outcome and where it's going to be Mayor-elect Paul Honeyman or anything like that. So I think they felt pretty comfortable about going ahead.
Now, Steve, if I might, are you getting emails? I'm getting them in which members of the public and interest groups are saying, aha, we have found discrepancies in some of the recounts. We know there are discrepancies. When are we going to hear about this?
Yeah, we get a few of those. I don't think we have gotten a lot, but we did certainly right after the election. There were a lot of people who were just claiming that there were major discrepancies and everything had to be recounted. For what it's worth, I feel fairly comfortable as a voter and a citizen of Anchorage that I think that they made the right decision to go back. And, there was one advocacy group that came out and raised enough money to count, I think, 15 precincts, I think. They
right.
went back. And I don't think, again, there weren't any major sea changes or anything like that where, you know, all of a sudden, one candidate picked up 500 votes on another or something like that. I think the count was all right. It's just the way that it happened, all the turmoil and tumult that led up to it on April 3rd. For what it's worth, too, my thoughts on Barbara Gruenstein, she was there for 9 elections, you know, and I like Barbara, and I think Barbara was a good public servant. I really do. But you knew that this was going to have to happen. She was going to have to go one way or the other.
Once the election got unanimous.
Yeah, because it was just, this is a symbolic departure, and I wish her well.
Let's get Tim Bradner in here. Tim, what do you know? A Resource Development Council luncheon turns into a rally against the EPA. Not that we haven't seen this before. What are the RDC members and allies concerned about this time?
Well, it's getting to be political season, so I guess we're bashing EPA. We're back and bashing the feds. This was a luncheon that was called to hear the story of a out-of-state couple who, the luncheon was an excuse to cite the sins of the EPA and the transgressions of persecuting these people. It's interesting that people non-resident to Alaskans were come up here and were feted at a luncheon the governor attends. And it turns into a big, as you say, a big EPA.
Well, they had won a big Supreme Court case, right?
Yeah. But I think, you know, Alaskans love to beat up the feds and beat up the EPA. And I wanted to mention the latest EPA sin being tossed around is this paper on the Pebble Mine, which has been circulating for a couple of weeks now. And this is a very unusual thing. It's obviously political in the sense that EPA prepared this paper at the request of the Bristol Bay of the Pebble Mine opponents. And that's, you know, they acknowledge that. It's a curious document, though, because the state attorney general points out that there's nothing in EPA rules or statutes that provides for this kind of a opinion paper that's issued before there's ever an application.
Does it have legal standing?
Well, that's what people are puzzled about. Apparently, no. It's just an opinion paper. And if you read the document, it lays out all the fish and feathers in Bristol Bay and the people who live there. And then it talks about, if a large mines develop, these bad things could happen. And this is what could happen to the fish. But really, there wasn't much new there that we haven't seen. That we haven't seen in all the TV commercials that have been running.
And it would take just one election to produce another opinion paper.
Yeah,
superseding this one,
yeah.
Right?
And the so what's curious is that this doesn't, you know, the concern is this is could set the stage for EPA taking some sort of an action to try to preempt the other federal agencies working on the project. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they may use this to wave around and as the permanent action starts. But I think it would be pretty drastic for the EPA to try to move to preempt a project and essentially preempt development on 15 million acres of mostly state land. Well,
doesn't even a project as big as Pebble, and we've discussed this before, and I'm pretty certain it has to be part of a decision to go or not go of a pretty traditional permitting and decision process, right?
Well, that's true, and the the project applicants are preparing applications now, and probably later this year or next year they'll formally submit their applications. It'll go through the traditional processes, and that's when a decision will be made, and all the project will be vetted, and all the evidence will be weighed, and people will decide yay or nay. But it's just curious the way this whole EPA thing developed. And
Paul, you wanted to add something here?
Well, they were invited in by the opponents, and that's odd enough for starters. But they claim they do have the jurisdiction to do this, that the Clean Water Act allows them to actually to rule downstream discharges before an application is even filed. And that's what the opponents now of Pebble are asking them to do, or trying to get them to do, is move, even before it's applied for, to move to close. Well, you can do whatever you want to do, but you can't discharge downstream. So that's a tricky business.
There's been only four cases where the EPA has done this down south, all with cases where after permits have been issued. There's been none in Alaska.
They have the authority.
They may have the authority, but it seems to me a very much of a stretch of that authority to do something on this massive scale affecting such large amounts of acreage.
I have to wonder, if I might, Tim, this is an election year, a presidential election, that's only a few months away. From that perspective, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea just from a purely political point of view?
I don't know.
Is there anybody even in an informed manner comment on that?
I don't know, Michael. I think, another way to look at this is EPA has these people after them. Maybe this paper, in the context and the size of this project, this paper was pretty lightweight in terms of the amount of issues, the complexity of the issues that are being dealt with. So is this a way in? EPA didn't really have a lot of money to put into this. So is this a way for EPA just to tell the opponents, look, we did this. You know, the opponents have this piece of paper to wave around with EPA's logo on it. I don't know. Maybe it's just, is this EPA's way of getting them off their back? I don't know. It's hard to read this.
It is hard. It's hard to, I read the executive summary and read part of it. Trying to wade through it is almost impossible. But I came away with this is not their best effort. These were people that were not dedicated to getting to the bottom of it. Maybe it won't, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you read this thing and you wonder, what really is this all about?
What is this about?
Perhaps nothing. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Tim Bredner. Ron Paul's supporters take over the Republican Party, as we heard, and last week we had Kyle Hopkins here, and he did a great job of exploring a story that he did, but we haven't heard your perspective on what this all means, and there's a national perspective to it as well.
Ron, every time I say Ron Paul's name, people call me up and yell at me, so I don't want to say anything. No, it's going to...
Now, why would they do that?
I don't know. I have no idea. It could change, in my view, it could change the face of the Republican Party in Alaska and the Republican Party across the country. They have a more a further right, more constitutional, absolutist kind of view of life that the Republican Party, I guess, had more of years ago and has slowly drifted towards the center where all of America lives. And these guys are in there trying to promote their principles, which are not bad principles at all. More Republicans should pay attention to them. But I think what's going to happen is the party's going to have this internal strife for a while, and then it'll find itself a few degrees right of center if it moves at all.
Steve, this I don't understand. At the same time, what Paul said, the Ron Paul's platform, he hasn't talked a lot about some of these things recently, is getting out of foreign wars, bringing back our troops from a whole lot of places, and cutting down the military budget, maybe even here. Legalizing marijuana, legalizing prostitution. These are not exactly the topics you hear at the top of the list at the Republican Women's Club.
No, you're right. I haven't heard that come up at all. No, he's very conservative. Obviously,
it's the money part of it.
Yeah, right. The prostitution and the marijuana thing. I don't see how that. Somebody have to explain that one to me.
They seem to go together.
I don't know, but they don't go with the rest of the platform, do they? I don't know. But it's he's to the right end of the party. He says he's not running for president anymore, but he hasn't conceded, but he doesn't have any money to wage a campaign anymore. But obviously they're setting things up for the future. In the future, it may be now for a lot of these things. They may change party rules. They may change the way the party acts up here, the way the party, what it stands for in Alaska, maybe more conservative in the future. So I think that's what they're laying the groundwork for. And as you mentioned, they've done this in several states now. I think it's going to mean for a lot of strife.
Yeah, it might be interesting for journalists like ourselves to see how they reconcile all these conflicting impulses.
Yeah.
That could be fun.
It fits for Alaska when you think about it.
Tim Bradner, two companies on the North Slope announced discoveries. Are we in the money?
Well, it's good news in a sense and sort of mediocre news in another sense. It shows that people are still drilling up there. We're still finding oil. There's oils left to be found. Brooks Range Petroleum, a small independent, and Pioneer Natural Resources, another independent but not so small, made discoveries announced in the last two or three weeks. One was 40 million barrels, the other 50 million barrels. Nothing to sneeze at, but it's not enough. Yeah, it's easy to read into this thing, well, that the problem's solved, there's oil still being found, and things are rosy again, but it's just not enough to really make up the deficit.
And in developing this, how far are these finds from the gas line? I mean, from the Trans-Alaska pipeline?
They're all relatively near existing pipelines.
They're just outside the current or the leasing pattern of the big companies.
Right, and that's good news because it means that they can be tapped up, they can be linked up fairly quickly. But, we just have to be, we have to find a lot more of these things to really offset that decline of the pipeline. We need to be finding 5, 6, 7 of these things every year. Because you add
two.
It up. Yeah, not two.
Now, these companies, which probably many of our viewers are unfamiliar with, how big are they financially? How would you describe their heft?
Pioneer is a hefty outfit. It's what's called a major independent, sizable company. A lot of operations in the lower 48. They were early into the North Slope. They were one of the first of the independents, the new independents, separate from the big majors like Exxon and BP and Conoco. They have a field called Ugarit, which is a small field west of Prudhoe Bay. Is offshore.
And it's if it's offshore, then it's not in operation.
Yeah, it is, but it's near shore.
It is.
Yeah, it's near shore, built in shallow water right offshore, producing about 5,000 or 6,000 barrels a day. The other company is a very small independent, Brooks Range Petroleum, and it's made up of, people remember Ken Thompson? This is a company that Ken is not heading, but he's very involved in. And I think he's on the board and is very active in the company. It's a group of small independents actually working together. And they've been exploring diligently on the slope for a number of years now and haven't really, they've made small discoveries, but this is the first one that appears to be, they can do something with. It happens to be 200 or 300 feet from an existing pipeline. So that's really
Hallelujah.
Good.
That's
good for them. If we just need
you want
a lot
to find
more
water, drill where there's water.
Yeah. Right? We just need a lot more of these outfits doing this.
Okay. I wanted to take a minute, step down from my moderator chair, and just tell you a little bit about the militia trial, which has been going forward in the courthouse here in Anchorage all this week. Will be going next week. We heard this week in the conference outside the jury that the prosecution will probably wind up its case by the middle of the day Wednesday, and the defense will present their case. As part of the defense's case for Coleman Barney, we were told by his lawyer, Tim Dooley, that he will testify, Mr. Barney will testify, and that will undoubtedly be an important moment in the course of the trial. This week, a couple of the important developments were the undercover informant, Gerald Olson, was finally cross-examined by the defendant's attorneys, and as is usual the case in these criminal trials, the undercover operative, the mole, the snitch, whatever term you're using of art or high or low lexicon, did not prove to be a sterling citizen. He had several criminal cases. He had a number of judgments against him. He was a contractor who was going to build a variety of cabins and cesspools. I believe this was here in South Central Alaska, and he took people's money and never built them. And so Mr. Dooley, as defense attorneys do in this case, read him the list of his offenses and then said, and you've made no restitution, have you, for this judgment? No. That went on for quite a while. Under questioning for Mr. Kirtner, who's representing Lonnie Vernon, one of the third defendant in this case besides Schaefer Cox, Kirtner asked the informant, Mr. Olson, now, you said you'd like to get paid for your services. In fact, contract money, it wouldn't be an hourly wage, but it would be payment for his services. How much did you have in mind? And Mr. Olson said, oh, I don't know, I think I'll start high. How about $300,000? And you had to think that this is the kind of thing that registers with a jury and really allows the defense an opportunity later on in the trial, perhaps summing up to say, and this gentleman wants $300,000, not of the government's money, but of your money, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, something like that. Then he asked him, Kirtner asked him if he was going to use some of this money to repay the people he had victimized. And Mr. Olson very piously turned to the jury and informed them that he was a new man. He did not say he'd found God, but that he was a new man and that he intended to live a new life and would try to repay some of the money. Also, very briefly, this week, Schaefer Cox's mother-in-law testified. It was very emotionally wrenching as they talked about their troubled relationship, and she talked about some speeches he'd made about the TSA at a Thanksgiving dinner, and it was a classic sort of story of the Thanksgiving dinner bore who won't shut up while people are trying to watching their ice cream melt on their pie while he goes on and on. A former church member who was a TSA agent also testified in what had been perhaps the most dramatic moment of the trial, single moment. I'm not quite sure what the impact was. It turned out that she and Cox had been over to her house many times, come for lunch, and the last time she saw him, he showed up wearing body armor, and that stuck in her mind. And then her name turned up on one of these many lists, which the government alleges were hit lists of federal officials. She also worked for the TSA, did Ms. Beauchamp is her name. And she had known Cox a long time, knew his family, and they showed her her name on this TSA list on the screen in the courtroom, on the blown up screen, and asked her how it made her feel. And there was a silence for a minute, and then she said, betrayed. I can't really convey how powerful a moment this was. And at some point Cox said, I love you, I would never hurt you, I love you. And the judge reminded him he couldn't talk, but the whole effect, it was just very emotional. I had never seen anything quite like that, but I've talked enough. Steve, ICER reports federal spending has declined here in Alaska, and we're going to see more of it, even though we're still receiving more federal dollars than other parts of the country, 40% more than the national average. Tell us more about the ICER report.
Yeah, well, they looked at the federal spending here in Alaska. Of course, we're heavily dependent on the federal government. Most of Alaska is owned by the feds. There are significant holdings, federal holdings up here, military bases, things like that. So we get a lot of federal money. I think on average per Alaskan, we get about $3,000 per Alaskan, and that's far higher than any other place in the lower 48. The ICER report said things certainly have flattened out, and it could start to dwindle here as the federal government takes further actions against government spending and looking to cut budgets. So it could possibly dwindle a little lower in the near future. They certainly don't see it increasing. ICER doesn't. Certainly doesn't see it increasing over the next so many years because of the emphasis the federal government seems to be placing on making a smaller government. Part of the other issue I think here is there's been a war against earmarks in Washington. So that was a way that a lot of money was funneled here by former Senator Ted Stevens, whom we mentioned earlier in the broadcast. Some of the media, I know the Anchorage Daily News talked to Senator Mark Begich and Senator Lisa Murkowski about the ICER report. And both of them said that it's much more difficult these days. There is the ill will about the earmarks. It's much more difficult to bring federal money home these days. So for both of those lawmakers.
Thank you very much, Steve. Speaking of time, we are out of time. Have a wonderful Memorial Day holiday. We'll be back here with Alaska Edition next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.